Ladies and gentlemen, it is now time!
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah!
I finished these fights.
Give me a hell yeah!
Top Rope Nation.
Learn the rabbit! It's the best thing going today.
What's up, everybody? It's episode 259 of Top Rope Nation. I am Ryan Drosty, as always. I don't have Kyle. I don't have Justin here with me, but I do have a very special guest who we will be welcoming momentarily. Brand new book, just hit the shelves, Mr. Stephen Bell. He wrote it on the British Bulldogs, Tom Billington, the Dynamite Kid, and of course, the British Bulldog, Davey Boy Smith. We had a great, about 1 hour discussion on the process of writing the book itself, his research, the different Hart family members that got involved, Tom Billington's family members who got involved, and just overall the process in writing the book, how it turned out, and a great discussion on classic wrestling, the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s. I think you're all really going to enjoy this. As always, if you do, please be so kind as to hit that subscribe button down below here on YouTube, or if you're listening on the podcast feeds, hit subscribe, rate, and review as well. So without any further ado, let's take you to my discussion with Mr. Stephen Bell talking the British Bulldogs. We are here with a very special interview this week on Top Rope Nation. We are joined by Mr. Stephen Bell, author of Dynamite and Davey, The Explosive Lives of the British Bulldogs. It's kind of the hot new book right now in the wrestling world. Just dropped July 1st. I just finished my copy. It is an excellent read. Outstanding reviews that I'm seeing across social media on Amazon.com. We're going to talk about it here. We're going to talk about the process of writing the book, the research, and of course, both Davey Boy and the Dynamite Kid as well. So, Mr. Bell, Stephen, how are you doing today?
Great, thank you. Thanks for having us, Ryan. Finally, this is sort of take two in a day. I forgot it was my brother's wedding on the previous day.
That's right. Yeah, we've been planning this interview for a few weeks, so I'm glad we got to get it together. I'm just getting over a cold, so from our usual listeners, they might tell I sound a little bit raspy, but I think I'm going to make it because I've been looking forward to this one for a very, very long time. Stephen, one of the things we like to do when we get someone on Top Rope Nation for the very first time is to just kind of acclimate yourselves to our listeners so they kind of know, you know, who they're listening to here on the pod, what their background is as a professional wrestling fan. So I just want you to, again, introduce yourself in regards to how you grew up as a wrestling fan. You kind of cover this at the start of the book, but for the benefit of those who are listening right now and they haven't read it yet, when did you get into wrestling and then how did your fandom evolve?
Yeah, well, forgive me if I go on a bit longer because it will probably mean that I automatically go straight into how I came about to write about Dynamite and Davey and the Bulldogs. And that's because I think a lot of my generation, especially here in the UK, you've probably heard of the sort of Sky TV generation, which fell perfectly in line with the golden generation. Here in the UK, British wrestling was effectively sold down the river and was a non-entity, or it was, you know, in real, real small venues, not on TV, no syndication at all whatsoever. That was sort of in the early 90s as the big golden generation boom of the WWF was going on, and Sky TV syndicated and bought rights for the UK to show WWF programming. So us, as me and all my generation, as 8, 9, 10 year olds around that time, just fell in love with wrestling. Absolutely loved it. It was one of the only things we talked about, reacting in the playground. Don't do it at home, kids. Davey was obviously a huge hero of ours at that point. The Union Jack obviously really rammed down his throat, loved it, couldn't get enough of Davey. And then I think as most kids of our generation did. As we got a little bit older, we thought we were a little bit cool for wrestling at that point. And the WWF, as we all know, at that point in the mid-90s, was on a bit of a slump. But then a few years later again, as we, our teenage years, our later teenage years, it was the Attitude Era, which weird how we then become Vince McMahon's target demographic for the second time. It's space of a decade almost. So we all got back into it again. Absolutely loved it again. It was the coolest thing on TV. What else did, you know, 16, 17-year-old lads want? And it's weird how Davey, I'd say Davey and The Undertaker were the only two at that time who sort of transcended them two generations. And by that point, as I got older, I'd come to appreciate the fact that it was really local to me from a small mining town, extremely similar to mine. They're all very similar, these mining towns. Everybody's really humble, very same sort of people. So I sort of appreciated a shared heritage that I had with Davey at that point. And admired him even more because I knew what sort of humble beginnings he'd come from to then be this larger-than-life character alongside Hulk Hogan and The Undertaker and people like that. So found that absolutely fascinating. Even more so, me and my brother got so much into it that we were desperate to find out everything that had happened in between and before. So we set about getting a friend of ours who curated a massive collection of the old VHS tapes going all the way back to WrestleMania 1. And we worked his way through them all. So as we got to WrestleMania 2, on, you know, night 2, there are the British Bulldogs, plural. And that the first time I ever was introduced to the Dynamite Kid, Tom Billinen. Now, all I thought at that point, because Davey's still in my young mind, Davey was the star, he was the British Bulldog, and these were the British Bulldogs. So I assumed that, you know, they just sort of got somebody to tag team with Davey, some English guy, some British guy. And it was only when I started reading and getting into it more and more, behind the scenes stuff, as all the books started coming out, particularly Mick Foley's book. Tom isn't mentioned in it much, but what he is, Mick puts him over so much as, at that time in the mid-80s, 86 time, probably the best wrestler in the world. That sort of piqued my attention. So this is still 20 years ago now. And I thought, well, I want to know more about him now. And then when I found out that they were first cousins, so we were also from the mining town, also shared that heritage, first cousins, I had no idea about that. As I found out that, I was absolutely fascinated with this story. And I say that's going back 20 years. Read more and more books. Obviously, read Brett's book, read Tom's book. Sort of started absorbing everything that I could about behind the scenes type stuff. Did a lot of research on the British wrestling background. And so then, when years later, I'd had two successful sports books already, and my publisher offered me a chance to do another one. And my second one ends, the final third of my second book is pro wrestling themed, and it almost transcends into the Snake Pit and the evolution of pro wrestling in the north of England, where we're from, around the mining towns, and how that all started. And it just felt like kismet, it felt like serendipity that the publisher wanted me to do a third book. I'd had this idea, what I didn't even know were an idea at the time, 20 years before, and I'd already sort of started that research all over again for the end of my previous book, and it just felt like destiny almost at that point. So I said, yeah, I want to do the Bulldogs, and they backed me all the way.
That's awesome. I think our experiences were very similar, or we must be about the same age. So I'm 38.
36.
Okay, so there we go. Because I can like faintly remember seeing the Bulldogs, you know, when I was very young at you know, the very early stages of my fandom, you know, and seeing them come out with Matilda and stuff. But yeah, mostly growing up, it was like the British Bulldog to me, singular, too. And I didn't know a ton about Tom Billington until later on. And you mentioned, you know, being a younger fan and that kind of the end of that golden period. And then they draw us back with the Attitude Era. It's really unique because there's so many people about our age who are, you know, very hardcore into wrestling, because we live kind of through two boom periods at, you know, the perfect ages, I would say, as a young kid and then like as a teenager.
Yeah, we were that perfect demographic at that time. And I think that's why there is such a hunger and a thirst for, you know, all the podcast series that are out in about a minute. Most of them are themed around them eras because it was such a boom period. And there's so many interesting topics to talk about, interesting people, the for good or bad, the stories are fascinating around that time. And, you know, despite what's going on now, it's a lot cleaner industry. It's a lot more regulated industry, a lot better for the people involved, to be involved, not as dangerous an industry. But I don't think in 30 years' time there's going to be 50 award-winning podcasts around what we're going off around this time. So it's like a right. Catch-22, you know, that they're never going to quite capture that magic in a bottle that they did back then, because they've learned the lessons from it, but we were around to appreciate it at the time, I think.
100% agree. You kind of mentioned this a little bit with like the air in Northern England and the mining towns and stuff. And you tell that story in the book, you know, the area of England that Tom Billington was from, and how that kind of drew you in as a fan. And as an American, I didn't really understand the dynamics, you know, of the geography of your country and the types of people that emanate from each region and everything. So, I mean, for the Americans listening, and we do have a strong listenership over where you're at. About 15 to 20% of our listeners are from the UK. So shout out over there. But for the Americans listening and all around the world, explain a little further about where Tom and, of course, his cousin Davy Boy Smith came from, and how that upbringing and being from that area of England impacted their journey to the ring.
Yeah, so there's a real north-south divide in the UK. So the south of England, obviously London, and where all everything to do with Westminster, everything like that goes on, it's a lot more affluent. There's a lot more money flying around there, a lot more jobs, a lot more opportunities. You know, and where I'm from, particularly back then, the jobs for men, you know, and they were, it were really an alpha male dominated communities, you know, the men were the breadwinners, and there wasn't many different types of jobs that they could get upon leaving school. None of them were going to be going to university, or very few were going to be going to university. They're not going to be getting jobs as doctors or lawyers. So, but there was a thriving mining industry, and we are the mining towns, as they are all known. So the first port of call for most boys of working class families would be, at what age are you going to start going down the mine? You know, that's what it was. And what are you going to be? Are you going to be an electrician? Are you going to be a mechanic? Are you just going to be a shift labourer? And, you know, that's all it was. And then Margaret Thatcher's Conservative government in the 70s, in the 80s predominantly, shut down the mines because, you know, it was more economic to get that industry shipped in rather than mine it yourselves. So the heart was ripped out of them communities. What was previously a bordering on the poverty sort of stricken level, but everybody was okay. Everybody was, you know, food on the table. And then that got taken away, and everybody was plunged into poverty for a period of time before a bit of a leveling up campaign across the country brought us up to speed. And now a lot of us do go to university and move on to that. But it were really hard times for these people, and there wasn't many options apart from going down the mines. And that had an impact on everything, even down to the average age of death, you know, because there was accidents down the mines. They were coming out of there hard of hearing, broken backs, broken down men, because it was such hard labor. But sport was one other realistic option. We have the sport of rugby league is pretty much only in the mining towns, and that's the reason that was because that's what they were. They'd come out of the mines and they would wrestle and grapple with each other. And then so the more affluent sport of rugby as a whole, even that was forced into the divide. So it got the north of England almost got its own sport that was for these miners. But wrestling evolved out of that in the 20s and the 30s, catch as catch can wrestling, predominantly in Wigan, became such a thriving product and a realistic option as that became pro wrestling. And then TV companies got involved. And when the TV companies got involved, the north of England had this wealth of talent that were born out of just ordinary working class men or boys who were excellent at pro wrestling because it's what they've been brought up doing, or rugby league or soccer, you know. And so when there was, when they needed talent for the pro wrestling to fill the rosters, suddenly there was a realistic option of further employment in that for these lads from the mining towns that wasn't there before. So lots of them jumped at that chance. That led to gyms opening up in and around that Wigan and Warrington area. One of them was the World Renowned Snake Pit, and another one was Ted Bettley's gym. And one fateful day, Ted Bettley met a 13-year-old Tom Billington, and that's where the story begins.
And it is quite the story. It's, like I said, it's an excellent read. You go very in-depth in Tom's early days in England and what he experienced at the gym and, you know, being kind of an undersized guy. And that was, you know, something that played into his psyche, as we all know, throughout his entire career. Is, you know, he was this smaller guy with 5'8" or so. And he had to pack on the muscles, you know, any way he could, especially when he got to Calgary. And that's what he did. So, you mentioned you had the idea for this book, of course, you know, growing up a fan, and then you had already written two books for your publisher and got the chance to do a third one. So as you began the process of writing this book, what was it like? I mean, what was your process like in researching for the book? What kinds of resources did you have at your disposal? How did that go for you?
Well, one thing that, so it's obviously, I'm from the UK, as we've discussed at length, but I've got a UK publisher as well. And what I noticed was, because I was watching, reading, listening to as much as I possibly could about pro wrestling from that era, predominantly anything that was that focused on Dynamite and Davey as well, and I'd been for some years, really. Virtually all of them publications were American or Canadian based, just because of what they were, be it Mick Foley's book or Brett's book, or and then obviously there's been a Dark Side of the Ring. And I didn't feel like this story had ever been truly told to a British audience, and these were two of our finest sporting exports, as far as I'm concerned, especially two of our local lads from the north of England. So I really felt like there was a story to tell, even if that was, if I'd have done the best I possibly could with just everything that I had at my disposal. So that's all the books that have been written. I mean, virtually every member of the Art family has written a book for, so that would have been a good place to start. I quickly got myself a couple of British wrestling historians to help me out with facts and figures and dates. So that just added some meat on the bones, made sure I could get it all in a perfect chronological order. But I thought, well, this could be good just at that, and then I will obviously really try. So I satisfy myself that there was a story to tell and a book to write for a UK audience, even if I didn't manage to speak to any family members at that time, because you're in a catch-22 situation with that, because families in that scenario, before they give you any kind of green light or waste any of the time on you, you've got to prove yourself to them, and you've got to break down that barrier and break down that door and gain their trust. And to do that can be difficult. So I had to satisfy my publisher on one side that there was a book to be delivered no matter what, and I could give them a date and a deadline and some, you know, projections of what I thought I might do and target demographics. But on the other side, I really wanted to make it as big and new and fresh as I possibly could. And I knew I wanted family members involved for that, and other wrestlers. And so I set myself sort of a minimum and a maximum sort of project of what it could be. Once I'd got that, and I'd got sort of a bit of a cover designed, a word count in mind, all these ideas, some real meat on the bones, I felt like I were in a position to go to family members and prove, you know, I told them about, introduced myself, told them my history of my two previous books, the success that they'd had, and here I was, and is, you know, like what I've got in mind for this. And I still found it difficult. Now, the first barrier that I broke down was I managed to get in touch with Bruce Hart. Bruce Hart had such a key part of the story. You know, he discovered Dynamite. I mean, that's a wonderful story in itself, how he discovered Dynamite and enticed him over to Canada as a young boy. And so I had a sort of 3 or 4 hour chat with Bruce. That went excellently. And really enjoyed getting his take on things. As I said, I'd already read his book, but I wanted a little bit of new content from him, a little bit of clarification on things. We talked for hours just generally about British wrestling from his time over there. It's such a great memory of people that he'd met. So we just talked for hours. And I'd obviously made a good impression without realizing it. I'd made a good impression. So then Ross Hart got in touch with me and said, I spoke to my brother Bruce. He were quite impressed. I'd like to contribute as well if I can. Absolutely, right? We're rolling now. Same again with Ross. Had a four-hour conversation. Really hit it off with Ross again, to the point where we almost turned into pen pals about it. And I felt like I could send him long rafts of emails asking him questions, and he would get back to me with answering everything that he possibly could in great detail. It took a lot of time to make sure he got things right. He would be open and admit to me if he didn't know anything about it. But then he did the same as what Bruce had done with him, and he spread the word to other family members. So that's how I got to speak to Bronwyn Billington and other people. And from there, yeah, I really built up sort of a small group of family that I could turn to for anything. And Bronwyn and Ross were particularly brilliant, particularly helpful. And that's why I asked them to write the foreword and the afterword respectively, just because they contributed so much. They'd put their heart and soul into it as well. And I really felt like their names deserved to be on the front cover alongside mine. Bronwyn in particular, afterward, I really wanted to end it on that note. And I knew what note I wanted to end it on. But after she told me the story, I really felt like that story needed telling in her words rather than mine. So I asked her to tell that story as the sort of happiest ending that the book could possibly have. And yeah, it seems to have gone down really well.
Agreed. Yeah, the influence of Stampede, of course, on both guys' careers, and the way you tell the story of, you know, Bruce coming over there, Stampede on its last legs, and him bringing Tom back, and that kind of giving rebirth to the territory again. I've read Pain and Passion years ago, History of Stampede Wrestling. Of course, I've read Brett's book. I've read several books that cover Stampede Wrestling, but there was stories in your book that I don't believe I've heard before. And the way that you tell the story in the book, it's almost like, I feel like the best nonfiction books can oftentimes read like a good fiction book, in that like it draws you in with like the dialogue, the way you insert dialogue and stuff to tell the story makes it very engrossing to read. And it was truly a book like I couldn't put down. And that was my favorite section of the book, was the Stampede portion, which probably makes, what, I don't know, a quarter of the book or so, I would say offhand. It's a healthy chunk of the book.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
I was just gonna say, it had me like wanting to dig up the old footage constantly. Like I wanted to dig up footage of that match or that promo. And a lot of that I hadn't seen in years. So I was, you know, pulling out Brett's original DVD or wherever I could find some of that, or going on dailymotion.com, because YouTube pulls a lot of stuff, you know, to try to find that footage. I mean, the book to me was more than just reading the book, but then it was also just like going out and searching out footage too, and it became this whole thing of just reliving that era a little bit.
Yeah, well, just a little side note here, my dad is like almost completely anti-wrestling, like, you know, always sort of scoffed at it as when we were watching it as kids and also as teenagers. And but obviously he reads my books, because in fact I always give him the first copy, you know, because I want him to, he's always the first person I want to read my books. And even he has been watching footage of Dynamite in particular, because of how much I've put Dynamite over it. He got so fascinated by what Dynamite could do and the ground that he broke, that even he's been getting YouTube footage up and sort of had his jaw to the floor watching it. So yeah, I had so much result. I found Stampede and the whole thing, the whole relationship, so fascinating. The fact that they got so ingrained there, you know, both of them only went over, supposed to go over such a short period of time, ended up spending such a large portion of their lives there, set down family ties. And it's where they are most indelibly linked to now. And the links to the Hart family and Stampede Wrestling, I found it so fascinating. And I had such a well through Ross, through Pain and Passion, you mentioned. Heath McCoy has become a friend of mine, because I reached out to Heath and he couldn't wait to read the book. And he's since admitted to me almost that he was almost a little bit nervous to read it, because he knew what an amazing story it could be, and he really wanted somebody to make a good job of it. And he's written the most amazing review of the book, a bit like similar theme to what you've just said. I think the style was something that I really, really desperately wanted to do and achieve, because I think it's such a dramatic tale and such a humanistic story that I really wanted the reader to go on that roller coaster with the guys. I didn't want it to just be... Cause I had so many contradictory stories. You know, you could get bogged down with quotes. You know, so-and-so said this in his book, but then so-and-so told me this in an interview, and then so-and-so said this in a magazine once, and in shoot interviews. There's so many contradictory stories that I didn't want. I wanted to write the book that I'd want to read. So what I did, I took all that information together and threw it by amalgamating them all together, giving everybody a little voice within them, tried to amalgamate it into one scene and then another scene. So it flew, and the reader really felt like they were there and enthralled with it. And everything that I've got suggested it works. Now, a little story as to why that style works so well for me and why I enjoy writing that so much is because my second book, which is The Man of All Talent, The Man of All Talents, The Extraordinary Life of Douglas Clark. Now, Douglas Clark was he was born in the late 1800s. He's from my hometown. He went on to be an unbelievable war hero, like genuine war hero. He's got his own shrine at the War Museum. But he was also one of the best ever rugby league players, a real pioneering rugby league player. Worked out, was a coal miner. And then when he finally did hang up his rugby boots, he turned to professional wrestling in 1930 and went on to be Britain's first ever world heavyweight champion. Now, kayfabe was so absolute in them days that I could do all kinds of research about his, and he'd actually written down his memoirs up to the point of professional wrestling, and then he just wrote nothing. Because what could he write? You know, I split that up into three parts. Part one was his life as a rugby league player. Part two was his war life. And part three was his professional wrestling career, which I had his stats on his matches, who, where, when, who won. And I'd got some third-hand reports, newspaper reports, chronicling the matches. But other than that, I had to use that same style where I didn't have direct quotes from him. I didn't have direct quotes from anybody else who were there. So I decided to write in that style that flew. Then I went back and rewrote the bit. I loved it so much that I went back and rewrote the war section because I thought it had a lot more dramatic effect. Went back and wrote the first section on the rugby league. So that book ended up being written in that same style. And I really felt like it worked really well. And the reviews for that were so good that I thought, yeah, I'm going to stick to that. And I think any story that's got that sort of dramatic human side to it can really be written in that manner. And that's what the reader wants, I think.
Yeah. I mean, especially like the car rides that you tell during the Stampede days. I really like the ones, especially when Harley Race was up there. There's some great stories in the book around that time period.
Well, that one in particular you're talking about, that was one of my favorite bits, and that was because Tom tells a version of that story in his book. But so I done a shortened version, or just sort of, I wanted to tell the story of how he met Harley Race, because Harley Race was really key to Tom's development, I think. And, you know, how he developed a lot of the mentality that he did. He respected him so much. I thought that was key. And the fact that he met him in that manner with that story. And Tom tells that story in his book, but that was the only account that I had of it. So I'd paraphrase that. But then when Ross saw that, he went, "That's wrong." He says, "We've got that from," and I said, "Tom's book." He went, "Right." He says, "I have come across that version before, and that must be where that rang a bell with Ross." He went, "But it's wrong." He says, because I think Tom had written that it were with Brett, and he'd got some other facts wrong about it. He went, "It were Keith that it were with." He went, "You need to speak to Keith." So Ross put me in touch with Keith, and Keith wrote me down that story, a long, long story, told me that it's that story, you know, even down to like what it was that they were drinking and the fact wow. what alcohol volume it was, which is why they were so worried about Ali driving and why it led to that incident. And I thought, wow, this is gold, absolute gold. So I wrote it in my style as I would and sent it back to Keith, and he just gave me a thumbs up and says, yeah, you've got it and won this. So that's like a typical example of how a lot of the stories came to light. I felt like it got to a point where I felt like it was snowballing so well, one thing will lead into another. And it ended up being, as I said earlier, I'd got this version of events where one would be, I just almost paraphrase what other people have done and tell the story in my own way, and put it out there for a UK audience who haven't had sort of full access to it before. The utopia being everybody's on board, everybody tells me a story. And at that point, it felt like I was a lot closer to that one now. Mm-hmm. And that's where I feel I ended up. There's other people that I'd love to be involved who weren't. But as I say, that would have been too perfect almost.
Yeah, for the listeners, you got to read the book to get the full effect of this story. But I can hardly imagine being, you know, if you're driving in a car down the road, there wouldn't have been much traffic at that night when this was happening. But if you would have saw this happening on the side of the road, I mean, the gist of it is Harley was drinking some high alcohol beer and they got to a point where that wasn't going to be so safe for this car ride and some violence happened, and you got to read the book. It's a great story. You really, really bring it to life.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite parts, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, talking to the Harts and Tom's family and everything, what would you say the timeline was when you started researching this book up to publication? How long did you work on this project?
Well, it's interesting. A lot of people ask me that, and it's always difficult to put a time on it, especially with this one, because my research almost goes back 20 years, you know, but mm-hmm. from actually deciding and telling the publisher, this is what I'm doing next, this is where I'm going, and sort of working on a title and starting to put it all into a logical time frame, getting all my sources together, up to submitting the book, it were about 18 months, and then it was sort of another 6 months then of fine tuning, fine editing, and leading up to release date. So yeah, it ended up being close to 2 years, really.
Okay. And was there, as you were writing the book, was there a particular era that you enjoyed researching and writing about the most, whether that was, you know, Stampede or like the early training days in England or the WWF or Japan or the later years for Davey's wrestling career? I mean, any particular time period that you enjoyed the most, could you pick out?
Time period, I would say in and around Stampede, not just the Stampede, but the stuff that were going on in and around there on the personal lives as well. But I think it more of a subject matter rather than a timeline. It was their relationship that I absolutely got enthralled with, you know, and the peaks and troughs, where it started off, why it started off. That was something that I found out because in both Brett and Bruce's book, they intimate, but they don't say why Dynamite was dead against Davey coming over in the first place. They just say there had been some family issues or whatever there might have been. And it were always a bit cryptic. And I did find out, or I got a strong theory and what I believe probably was the case told to me. And that's how I write it in the book. So I felt like that was a real sort of nugget for it, that were great that I'd got that in there. Cause that was the start of that roller coaster ride, because there was a feeling, I think, that Tom resented Davey for getting into the business and following him into the business and riding on his coattails a little bit. But then that roller coaster ride starts when Davey truly does earn Tom's respect after Tom's almost tortured him a little bit and stretched him and made him really earn his stripes. But once he does, they become this sort of loyal unit, go and take on the world together for years and absolutely conquer the tag team wrestling world. I think that's what a wonderful story. And then ultimately the breakdown of the relationship starts again, both professionally and personally. And yeah, they end up sort of mortal enemies almost again. And I really found that so fascinating. And to find out little nuggets of information, I found out a lot more about what a lot of your listeners will know, but probably not to the detail that I researched and managed to find something out, was the trademarking issue of the name. Mm-hmm. That was a real bone of contention for Tom, a real sense of betrayal. But I did find out more about that and how it came about, and it happened so organic and so you know, just almost unbelievable, really, how something what was such a simple, almost misunderstanding ended up being something that drove a wedge between them, and then another wedge, and then another wedge, and they ended up where the war never to speak to each other again. So yeah, there's quite a lot in there, I think, that people know a little bit about their relationship and the ups and downs, but there's an awful lot in the book that'll explain why that happened.
Yeah, absolutely. Were there any aspects of either man's career that you gained maybe an even greater appreciation for as a result of writing the book?
Yeah, I think I think particularly the Japan stuff, Davey is overshadowed by Tom. When you look at what Davey accomplished over there as well, it was phenomenal. One particular story that I really liked when I discovered it was him going over there against Tom's wishes to start with and having his first match there under a mask as White Tiger, that they've called him, and the crowd genuinely thought it were Dynamite because of the style and the look. At the time, they thought it were Dynamite under a mask, and he blew the crowd away. And Dynamite is so indelibly linked with Japan, and the Bulldogs as a team are. But yeah, Dave is a real legend over there too. And there were a lot of things like that. I think Tom, in the late 70s, sort of 79, has been regarded as this your best wrestler in the world sort of tag. When the Tiger matches started, I think, is when people think that. So around the 82, 83, 84 period is when people associate the best of the Dynamite Kid. But you'll go back and watch some of them matches from 79. Was one from Stampede against Fujinami when it was almost unknown to the rest of the world. New Japan and Stampede did a collaborative tour, and Tom was obviously picked to be Fujinami's challenger. Yeah. And they absolutely tore the roof every night, and that is what led to New Japan taking Tom, and that's what led to them putting the faith in him to be Sayama's opponent to really get the best out of Tiger Mask, and that's where that all started. So yeah, it were endless, really, with the stuff, and rewatching some of the matches that I hadn't watched in years, like Davey at Stampede, at Calgary Stampede in your house, and it were a real joy, it were a real labour of love. And digging deep on some of the things that I either already knew but found out a lot more about, or revisited, or finding new stuff that was completely new to me. It was a true pleasure.
Mm-hmm. That's what the best wrestling books do, is they serve as a gateway to, you know, pull out the stuff you haven't seen in years and years and years and kind of see it through new eyes. Like I was saying earlier, that's kind of what this book did for me, whether it was, yeah, some of the matches against Tiger Mask in the early 80s, or the Stampede stuff, or even some of the tag matches from the WWF or Japan, you know, whether that's New Japan or All Japan. I mean, this is, yeah, it'll get you pulling out the archives. It made me wish that some of this stuff was on Peacock or the WWE Network for those of you overseas, and was a little bit easier to access for sure. But I, you know, there's other ways to see it, and you can pull it up fairly easily.
There is. I mean, Stampede did appear on the network for a little while, but then I think most of it's been pulled off now. But yeah, I was gutted when that disappeared, because it is such a treasure trove of memories. The stuff they were doing in Stampede around that time served to inspire so much of what we went on to see in the 90s and onwards. You know, particularly as I describe in the book, the ladder match between Bret and Dynamite. Became the blueprint, but people, it went that far back in time that people almost forgot that that was the blueprint, but it was the one that everybody built the ladder matches on from that point.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to ask you something about these guys' personality, because so obviously Tom Billington has been known for years and years to have been a guy that was a little rough around the edges in the locker room, so to speak. I mean, he loved to prank people to like a rather mean level, almost like a sadistic streak to him, whether it was putting laxatives in people's drinks or drugging people's drinks, you know, fights in the locker room. And, you know, as you tell the stories in the book, it really kind of comes across like Davey, when he came over to Canada, he was a pretty innocent kid. He was the younger cousin of Tom, and then, you know, maybe a little naive. And then Tom kind of corrupted him. And like, you know, Davey Boy too was known for doing mean stuff backstage. I mean, lighting a guy's bed on fire in a hotel. You tell that story in the book. So I want to ask you, how innocent do you think Davey Boy really was? Do you think he was totally corrupted by Tom and that's why he became that way? Or do you think that was kind of embedded in him too?
Well, you've kind of hit the nail on the head, but I tell that series of stories. The whole point is that what I like to do with things like that is let the reader make up their own mind. I don't end up using the word bully in it, because I think that's almost it's almost like convicting him in a way, Tom. I'm right. Talking about it. I think that word bully gets used a lot against him, and I understand why. And I think from certain people's point of view, you'll never tell them that it wasn't that. But from other people's point of view, you'll never tell them that it was, because they saw this side of him. I spoke to Gary Ports, who was Scott McGee in the WWF, at length over the phone. And he got really emotional down the phone talking about Tom. They had such a strong friendship. And he told me about when Tom had come to his aid after Gary had had a stroke, a serious stroke. It ended his career. He were only young, only in his late 20s. He had a serious stroke, and Tom took him in. He went and he had nobody else. He were in Calgary at the time, no family or friends around him. And Tom took him in, almost nursed him back to health. And then Gary repaid that favor when Tom broke his back. And they had this sort of mutual friendship of that nature for years and years and years. And he would not, he won't hear a bad word against him. And I understand that. So what I want to do by telling these stories was let the reader make up their own mind. This is what I believe happened. This is what I've been told happened. And it's up to you where you put him. I didn't want it to come across as any kind of hit job in any way, shape or form, because I genuinely don't think it comes across as that. It was never my intention. But I also don't want it to be a whitewashing. I don't want the reader to think, oh, he's ignored that part of it. So all I wanted to do was tell an honest account that tells the full story of these two boys from a local hometown and let people make up their own mind up. With regards to Davey, what I think it was truly is I think the term has been said a lot that it was a follower rather than a leader. I think that's probably true. And I think at that time, Tom was his leader. He was his team captain. He'd been that blueprint for Davey for success from the same humble beginnings. And I genuinely think he would have followed him into any kind of war at that point. I think he worshipped him. And yeah, it was probably, I would use the term, a massive influence on him in and out of the ring.
Yeah.
I think.
Kind of like Harley was on Tom, as you alluded to earlier. You know, like Tom wanted to learn how to carry himself. It was a whole different era back then. You know, you didn't want to get trampled on by guys in the locker room. You wanted to prove you were a real tough guy. As we said, Tom was undersized, so that played into him behaving the way that he did too. And, you know, I mean, in some ways it was a means to survival. It was also a way they kept themselves sane on the road.
Yeah, and I think the ultimate example of that, what you've said about Ali, is the lineage of the diving headbutt. You know, I think that almost acts as a... as a marker. It went from Ali to Tom to Benoit. Yeah. And you literally could see one be influenced by the other and then the other be influenced by the predecessor. And yeah, I think you're right. And I think Davey could handle himself so well, but I think he was so, even in them times when he was a real prankster, he was still softly spoken and still polite. And I don't think he ever sort of lost that side of him. And then after they did have the split, I really noticed that, particularly it comes across from Mick Foley, is Davey in the 90s was one of the most beloved guys in the locker room, you know. So, and any time it did come down to, you know, the example of the fight with the Marines with Shawn Michaels, you know, Davey was the one that could have ended a lot worse if it wasn't for Davey, you know. So I think he was supremely loyal. He could really handle himself. And yeah, people forget how young they were as well. God, everybody makes mistakes when they're a young man, you know. they were still in the early 20s when they were playing them pranks a lot of the time. And Davey forging his way. I think the other thing that gets overlooked is they were both in a foreign land, you know, far from home, trying to... be the alpha male that they'd seen from their fathers in the type of towns that I know we grew up in. And it was dominated by the alpha male types. And Tom's dad in particular, he was a boxer and a tough guy. So, yeah, I can see where it started and what path they went down, and they didn't want to go to across to that foreign land in the wrestling business of all businesses and look weak in any way. So that they made that stance. Tom made that stance first, and sort of David followed him into that stance. That they weren't going to be, they were going to ride roughshod over them. And yeah, I think as things took over, be it substances or steroids or whatever, yeah, they overstepped the mark. But yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, clearly in the end, the story becomes a tragedy, and there's no way around that. You mentioned having Bronwyn write the afterword and trying to give it some positive spin there, you know, at the end. But ultimately, yeah, it's a great tragedy because you got these two guys who are so ultra talented, and how it ended up with them. Now, if you could, I mean, this is a hypothetical, but if you look at Tom and Davey, and if, you know, they lived through this era where you had to have the body of a superhero, or they're on the road 300 days a year, what do you think their careers could have been like if they, I don't know, were 20, 25 years younger and they came of age, you know, more in the modern era in the 2000s? Like, what do you think their ceilings would have been as wrestlers?
It's weird because they, for Tom in particular, they created the ceiling, didn't they? So I think they would have been, as in-ring performers, they would have been awesome in any era. I do genuinely believe that. As individuals, I think they just like to forge their own path that much that I think conforming to what goes on now might have been difficult for them. It's difficult to know. In-ring, they would have still been as good as anybody around. I think the storytelling craft, which I think is what has been lost in today's wrestling, I think that's the problem. It's just high spot after high spot is all they seem to be going for, rather than the drama of the storytelling. And I think that's what these guys grow up on. I think they thrived on kayfabe still being a thing that they wore as a badge of honor. Mm-hmm. I think they would have struggled with the business. I don't think they would have struggled with the in-ring work at all, but I think they would have struggled with the landscape of the business, if I'm honest.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the in-ring work a little bit here. So I think most of our listeners are about our age. They're pretty familiar, but for people who aren't, or maybe they haven't watched that era in a long time, let's start with them as a team. You know, after spending so much time looking at their careers here, what are like a handful of British Bulldogs matches that you would recommend to people to either see for the first time or to relive if they haven't watched in many years?
I think first of all, as a tag team, British Bulldogs, probably WrestleMania 2 is the one that you want to start with, because it was a crowning moment. They did steal the show. I think, you know, it was such a ambitious project, was WrestleMania 2 with the three locations, and the Bulldogs were main event in one of the locations, and I do think they stole the show with that match against Valentine and Beefcake. It's a really unique ending, and Tom does a typical Tom thing when he doesn't need to do it, because it goes off camera, it goes completely off piste with that bump to truly sell the impact for the finish. Again, Rex is back again on the guardrail when he were off camera. He had no need to do it. The next thing, while David Boy's collecting the belts, Tom's dripping with blood. You know, he's clearly bladed. You know, after the bell, you know, just to get that effect that he desperately wanted, to make it the best possible match and the best possible finish it could be. Other than that, I think the best work is probably in Japan as a tag team. The matches against the likes of the Malinkos, it's just a clinical masterclass the whole way through. But you can see them against so many different types of people. You know, I mean, they had a brief feud with Big John Studd and King Kong Bundy in the WWF. You know, two big oversized lumps, and they even managed to get some great matches out of them. But then you can go all the way to, as I say, the likes of the Malinkos, where they're putting on these technical masterclasses. And then there's, you know, the likes against the Funks, any from that new the Japanese mid-80s era, I think, is where they really peaked. Did you want just as a tag team or individual as well?
I was gonna ask you individual then as well.
yeah, I think everybody would resort to Tom with Tiger Mask, understandably. As I said, I've already mentioned the match with Fujinami. That was my favorite that I discovered during the research. Just as if you've just got 7 minutes to spare, fire up Network and put on him against Tiger Mask at Madison Square Garden in 1982. It's there on Network. They've been given just this tiny time slot. And I think it's just so that Vince can see them. And so he can see Sayama, really. And obviously Tom was his main opponent. So they got them there. And the crowd, all the big guns are there at this 1982 show. And the crowd are almost treating this as the drinks break match. You know, they're all stood up, milling around, wondering who these guys are in the ring. After 30 seconds of the match, they're all stood watching, thinking, what's this? After 2 minutes of the match, they've all got their hands on their head, gasping in amazement. And it's just a 7-minute masterclass by them both. I think that, just as a short snippet, takes some beating. That really does show what they were capable of. Tom also had some fantastic matches in Stampede with Brett. Davey, I didn't think going into this that I'd see Davey have a better match than SummerSlam 92. I always thought that would be my favourite Davey match. But I think what I fell in love with about the when they did finally have the Brett rematch in Your House, Season's Beatings a few years later, when Davey was a heel, after doing so much research and studying about Stampede and the styles of wrestling, and the fact that they knew that the only way that they could even get close, let alone try and beat what they'd done at SummerSlam 92, was to get some juice and do some things that they would do in Stampede, almost turn the clock back 10 to 15 years to the things that they were doing then. Mm-hmm. Blading was pretty much completely embargoed, so they had to do it truly, truly surreptitiously, and Brett's an absolute master of that. And by the end of it, if you haven't seen it in a while, it's just, there's just claret everywhere.
King
on commentary is absolutely, you can tell he's not just doing sort of a fake sell for the audience. You can tell he's off his seat screaming about how good it is. I don't think anybody expected him to emulate what they'd done 3 years earlier. And I think once I'd done the research and figured out what went into that match and the planning of that match and how they pulled it off, that became my favourite Davey singles match then. But as an honourable shout out, I would just mention Canadian Stampede. I think that is probably my favourite, just for the audience. I think that is probably my favourite wrestling match of all time. You know, obviously not because of particularly what was going off in the ring, but the atmosphere was truly, truly electric. And that'll never be, I don't think that'd ever be seen again.
That is my favorite wrestling crowd of all time. We're actually going to be doing a whole episode just on that show for the 25th anniversary, which just happened, but we're going to be recording. This is like our Patreon bonus, Top Rope Nation Classics. We do that every month. We pick an old show that wins a vote amongst our patrons, and it's going to be Canadian Stampede. We're going to be recording that in about 2 weeks. I can't wait.
I'll listen with joy and watch along.
I started smiling instantly when you went to the In Your House Season's Beatings December 95, because we've brought this one up on the show a couple of times and debated it a little bit, because I mean, I love the SummerSlam match. I really like the In Your House match. I'm actually one of those people that thinks the In Your House match is better than the SummerSlam match. It's totally different matches, like you said, different feel to it. I always kind of like these rematches that are, I guess, like the hardcore fans maybe like a little bit more. Like, I'm the same way with Brett and Mr. Perfect. Love the SummerSlam 91 match, but I think their King of the Ring 93 match is actually better.
King of the Ring then, yeah. I probably agree, yeah. I think what it is, I think, whilst the SummerSlam 92 match is absolutely amazing for what they accomplished as a babyface on babyface match, I think what makes that so special is the old story regarding, you know, they do a lot using Diana in the crowd, mm-hmm. and the Wembley Stadium and the true drama of it and the fireworks at the end. I think the mastery of that as storytelling is just superb. And I think as a whole package, I think I probably would give it to that, but purely as sort of 20 minutes of wrestling, I think I'd probably go with In Your House.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying too. Like, as a whole package with Wembley Stadium, I mean, the larger than life presentation, you could give the nod to SummerSlam, but I think like between the ropes and outside the ring, I mean, God, yeah, that in your house match in December 95 is excellent. Excellent stuff. I also really like, I remember at the time even liking Davey and Owen, the European final.
Because that's magic. Yeah.
It just kind of felt like, I mean, I'd have to rewatch that era, but being pretty young, 13 at the time, it seemed to me like I didn't see Davey kind of flipping around so much anymore during that era, like he had when he was younger. And in that match, man, his agility is crazy, the way he moves around in the ring.
Yeah, you do right to bring that one up. And I think what makes it so good now is when you rewatch it, because it was shot in Germany and it wasn't shown live and the production levels are really low. So you feel like it's just going to be of almost house show quality performance, maybe, you know, where they're holding a little bit back. They absolutely majestic that night, both of them. And you can tell that it's almost... They incorporate all the different styles that they've learned over the years, because Owen was such a student of the global styles, spent a lot of time over here in the UK and Japan, and they both followed that same pattern with the dungeon training too. And it's almost like they made a conscious decision that night to just incorporate everything and have this absolute stellar match that you just never... It feels like every roll-up's going to be the end of the match, and they just keep going and keep going and keep going. That's a five-star match in anybody's book, I think.
Yeah, it just felt like a real kind of roll the clock back kind of match for Davey. It's just excellent.
Yeah, well, I think you see a lot of that if you go back and watch it against the likes of the Malinkos, for example. You see Davey doing that all the time. He'd got it absolutely mastered. He did it also, despite being probably his biggest at the time, he did a lot of that sort of stuff with Regal in the early 90s in WCW in 92, 93, I think that rivalry was. So, yeah, he definitely had all that in his locker. He widely regarded. I think that's something that I kind of knew, but it really still ingrained it in me even more. I put him up another notch as I did more and more watching, more and more research for the book, is just how, for a good 10 years, if he really wanted to, Davey, he could do absolutely everything in that ring. And I think that's easily forgot about. I sometimes think that because the two people who is so closely linked to are the Dynamite Kid and Bret the Hitman Hart, I sometimes think that just how good and how talented he was kind of gets diminished a little bit, because, you know, he's the two people who he's most closely compared to. But that's grossly unfair. As I say, I think for a good decade, he was one of the top 5 or 10 performers out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I put out there to our Patreon supporters, if they had any questions for you, I'd try to get to a couple of them that I thought were good questions. And Michael Jenkinson, friend of the show, he sent in this question. He wanted me to ask you if you thought that there was ever a time where it would have been justified or realistic for Davey to have been world champion, whether that be WWF or WCW.
Absolutely. I think it was just a twist of fate that he never was, really. I think a few minor things went against him. Never that great on the mic, I think, would be one thing that went against him. I think it was pretty much between him and Bret who got the nod in the post-Hogan when they wanted to move away from Hogan. And his failed drug test in... after SummerSlam in 92, which led to him going to WCW, who knows, I think, is the answer there for what he could have done in WWF going into 1993. In WCW, again, had a falling out with Eric Bischoff. I think he was on course there. I think he would have won the WCW title if it had stayed there even just 6 or 12 months longer. You look who wore passing that belt around between them at the time. Vader, Sting, Sid, it were right in there with them. They were in a sort of a four-way feud. I think it was just a matter of time before it were his turn. I think that mid to late 90s run, while I think it's a lot of Davey's best work back in WWF, I don't really think he was a realistic option then. I think it had probably had just about passed him by then. I know he was challenging a lot and he was everybody's perfect foil because he could get the best out of everybody. I think that's what they used him for then. I think it had gone past him then, but yeah, I think he can count himself very unlucky not to have had a world title run in either one or both.
Mm-hmm. So the influence of Dynamite Kid, obviously no secret. You've kind of been alluding to the fact that maybe from Davey's side, he was always being overshadowed by Dynamite or even Brett or some of the people he was surrounded by. So with Dynamite being one of the most influential junior heavyweights of all time, let alone as a tag team wrestler as well, let me ask you on the flip side, what do you think Davey's legacy is?
I think Davey's legacy almost transcends wrestling a little bit. He is an absolute pop culture icon here in the UK. He is known just indelibly, despite, again, from that fantastic run that, or runs plural that he had in the mid to late 90s. The dreadlocked Davey of the SummerSlam 92 sort of era is a pop culture icon in the UK. I think he enabled pro wrestling to survive here in the UK almost single-handedly in that period through the Sky TV coverage. And I think that that has led to the boom that we've got now. So many global superstars from here in the UK. And I think a lot of them, you know, your likes of Sheamus, Drew McIntyre, Wade Barrett, have all at one point or another name dropped Davey as a key influence in that. And I think that that says a lot for him.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting. You know, I asked you a little bit ago how these two would have fit in the modern scene and, you know, whether Tom would have been different if there wasn't the pressure on him to be so big, you know, in this era or whatever. I think Davey would have fit in so perfectly just personality wise, because you talk about in the book how, you know, beyond going to the bars and partying and stuff, this was a guy in the early days of video games who loved to video game. And that's one of those things you hear some of the old timers talk about now, like Undertaker famously always say, all these guys, all they do is sit around playing video games now. They need to go, you know, it seems like he's pining for the old days. Davey would have loved to have been one of those guys today on the road just playing video games in his hotel room, don't you think?
I absolutely agree. I think that's where the element of slightly being led astray, be it by Tom. I don't think you can just single Tom out on that. I think that it was a culture at the time that Davey got sort of led into that party culture. I think his maybe go-to was that with Owen. There's a really fantastic picture of him and Owen playing video games together, and they've just got these big beaming smiles. And their pranks that they got renowned for were just that little bit more lighthearted, not as serious. They were all fun and joke. When you hear Mick Foley talk about Davey, it's that side of him. He doesn't talk about the party animal Davey or anything like that. And Mick Foley, as we know, were almost teetotal, pretty much teetotal, and he stayed away from all that partying, and he really loved Davey. So yeah, I think I could see a little click forming there as that party culture were coming to an end with almost Mick and Owen and Davey. And yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It was Ross that pointed that out to me, just how much he loved that side, and he had this real playful side to him. And yeah, I think you're absolutely right to point that out.
Yeah. So I guess last question then for you. I mean, I feel like I could talk all day about old school wrestling with you. This has been a great interview. Where do you see the influence of the Bulldogs maybe on any current tag teams in the wrestling business? Or where do you see their legacy as a team kind of living on today?
I think the direct influence has possibly gone now, but the indirect, which is wider as it sort of fans out like a tree effect almost, is there in everybody. It's just there in tag team wrestling across the world, I think, is what the Bulldogs and the Art Foundation in particular and that rivalry really set out. I think the direct influences on that era, the Attitude era of the Addies and Edge and Christian and the Dudleys and a lot of what them guys were doing, I think that's where you saw that direct influence, and tag team wrestling really boomed. And it sort of made me smile when I saw them three teams in particular having those unbelievable ladder matches and doing the same spots that, again, Dynamite and Brett had set the blueprint for 20 years earlier. And you could really see a tangible influence from the Bulldogs and also from the Stampede stuff. So, yeah, I think there were an immediate swell of a direct influence for that era. But I think tag team wrestling got so big, so huge, almost the best match on the card. I think that's what the Bulldogs brought in. Before their time, generally tag team matches were either taught in ANS programs or they were for up-and-coming stars to cut the teeth, or they were for guys past the peaks on the downward down of the career who were a bit lumbering now and a bit slower to rely on each other, have to do less work. What the Bulldogs and the Hart Foundation influenced at that time was that the tag team match could possibly be the best match on the card, and then all of a sudden tag team matches were the genuine main events of matches. I think that's their lasting legacy, if I'm honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. They were definitely at the forefront of making like the workhorse tag team. Like you said, a lot of times it was guys put together who couldn't work a full match on their own and couldn't go anymore. They were older, and now we can go out and we can all have a good match, be athletic the entire time. And we see right now kind of, rejuvenation kind of maybe on a national scene with AEW. You know, they have a really good tag team division. WWE kind of, they have some good tag teams, but they haven't focused that much on it in a number of years. Whereas AEW has a thriving tag team division. You see FTR, you know, doing great stuff across multiple companies right now. And I think that's well taken.
I think what WWE still now do is almost have gone back to using tag teams just for enhancement of people or stories or performers. But as you say, AEW are more committed to an actual tag team division. And it doesn't feel like, I think it feels with WWE, and it's gone back a lot of years now, that it's only a matter of time before, they've had a falling out and now they're in a program with each other. It got so predictable that that's just what they were going to do, whereas it feels with a lot of other companies, AEW in particular, that tag teams are tag teams for a reason and they're going to stay that way.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, Stephen, on your way out here, what do you got on the horizon? Like, tell the listeners, first of all, where they can find you, where they can find the book, and then any upcoming projects you have coming for us.
Yeah. So the book is available worldwide now on whatever your Amazon ends in, be it .com, .ca, .uk. The book is available there. They can find me on Twitter at Stephen_Bell1985. I've got a dedicated page for the book, which has got an handle of at BulldogsBook123. I use that quite regular for updates on anything that's related to the book, pictures that didn't make the cut for whatever reason, or sort of anniversary of things and snippets from the book and exclusives. So if you want to give that a follow, you're more than welcome. Upcoming projects. I'm getting more and more sort of offers to write bits and pieces for wrestling magazines and stuff, which is really exciting. It's an area that I'd love to move into. There's so much requirement, I think, for people to know more and more about that era, and particularly the Wigan, what's known as the Wigan style and all that in Japan, and how influential that was. So that's something I'm doing more and more digging deep on. So hopefully there might be a book project in that in the not too distant future. I've got a boxing project on the go as well, which is also coming up to sort of a 30th anniversary. I don't know if anybody remembers it happened over here in the UK, but it was a guy from the States. Gerald McClellan was tragically injured in a fight with Nigel Benn. Nigel Benn was a working class hero of mine at the time. So that's another project I'm going to look to dig deep on and see where that takes me. So yeah, sports books will be coming out more and more. And yeah, I'll be doing more and more wrestling work as well.
Very nice. Awesome. Well, this has been a great discussion. Really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show and talk with our listeners about the book. As I said, highly recommended. You can find a link to it here in the podcast or the YouTube video description. And thank you very much, Stephen, for your time. This has been great.
Thanks, Ryan. Flew by that. Really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And thank you all for all the listeners for joining us. And we will be back next week with a brand new edition of the Top Rope Nation flagship here. Plus, by the time you're hearing this, or very soon, we'll have a new episode of Top Rope Nation Extra up. That'll be a Kyle Ross exclusive show that he is doing. And then all of us will be together, Kyle, Justin, and myself, doing a new Top Rope Nation Classics on Canadian Stampede 97, as I said a little bit ago. That should drop in about 2 weeks. So Top Rope Nation Extra, Top Rope Nation Classics, as always, exclusive to our supporters on Patreon. Look for a new flagship on all the podcast feeds next Friday. So with all that being said, this has been episode 259 of Top Rope Nation. For Stephen Bell, I'm Ryan Droste. We'll be talking to you again real soon. Take care.